from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. According to Dr. Daniel Kraft, digital healthcare is the wave of the future, from smart patches to sensors built into your contact lens.
And we're integrating this now with a whole era of cellular engineering and integrating exponential technologies for essentially 3D organ printing, replacing the ink with cells and essentially building and reconstructing a 3D organ.
Kraft is the chair of medicine at Singularity University, and he'll join us to talk about the potential and pitfalls of digital medicine as part of Forum's first-person series, which profiles Bay Area innovators who make our region unique. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. This hour, we're going to talk about the latest innovations in digital healthcare and ways that doctors and designers are adapting those health apps on your Fitbit or iPhone toward more personalized care. We're joined by Dr. Daniel Kraft, a Harvard and Stanford-trained oncologist who is also chair of medicine at Singularity University and founder of two medical startups, one dealing with stem cell-based regenerative therapies and the other with data-driven healthcare. He's been one of the physicians at the forefront of trying to connect technology with patients' needs to help prevent disease and lower costs in the long run. And he joins us this hour as part of Forum's first-person series, which profiles Bay Area innovators and leaders who make our region unique. Daniel Kraft, welcome to Forum.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. You've been listening to this program a long time, haven't you?
Since I was a medical student at Stanford.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you here. And let's talk about, first of all, what you call the Internet of healthcare, the Internet of body and healthcare, as opposed to the Internet of things. I mean, it's rapidly kind of changing one to the other.
Yeah, we've started only about 7 years ago with the first little wearables like the Fitbit that could track your basic steps and maybe your sleep. And now there's been an explosion of these sort of connected devices. Some of them can live on your phone. Some of them can be in your connected home. And as we think about the Internet of Things, we're not just connect our wrist sensors, but our connected mattresses, our digital genomics, our behavioral information that can be picked up by your phone and start to hopefully connect the dots so that we can make use of this. Here in the Bay Area, we coined the phrase quantified self, often the sort of uber geeks who want to track all their data. Now it's moving to quantified self, or hopefully together with your clinician and healthcare team, this data will flow and make healthcare more proactive rather than reactive.
Well, there are bigger breakthroughs in technologies and platforms and relationships to healthcare than it's a little bit like Brave New World. We'll maybe get into that. Let's talk about Singularity University first. And maybe exponential medicine, which are two things that you have become singularly identified with. Singularity University, many people think of Ray Kurzweil, who we've had on Forum, you know, mm-hmm. talks about extending longevity, maybe making us live forever, like this fame song sings. What's your role in all this?
So I've been involved since it started back in 2008, 2009. And Singularity University was a pretty unique institution based at the NASA Ames Research Park in Silicon Valley. And the real mission is to bring really smart folks together, leaders of today and tomorrow, to understand the pace of fast-moving and exponential technologies from genomics, robotics, 3D printing, nanotech, AI, how we can leverage those to impact grand challenges in the world, from poverty, education, environment, to healthcare. I was co-founded by Ray Kurzweil and Peter Diamandis. And what's quite amazing is we really help catalyze new thinking. Many folks know a lot about their little area. It might be oncology in my field. But to cross-train robotics or what's happening with 3D printing, not just where it is today in 2017, but where it's likely to be, is helping catalyze a lot of new startups, initiatives, and to help folks in their own lives or businesses disrupt themselves rather than wait to be disrupted.
Well, you have all these digital tools. You alluded to some of them. We'll talk about some more actually solving big healthcare problems. And let's talk about some of these. I mean, some of the more promising ones, some of the ones that people maybe don't know about, because there's a big question that's been raised with how we find the right platforms. We have all these all this data now, and what to do about it.
I mean, that's the huge challenge is we're in this age of exponential data. How do you make it exponential or useful information to you as a consumer, as a patient, as a physician? It's overwhelming. And I think what we're starting to see is the blend of the data and the machine learning and artificial intelligence to make sense of that and apply it to you and to personalize it. This idea of even precision digital health, that the app and the wearables you use match, you know, Michael's personality and age and language and culture rather than across the spectrum. So a lot of these things often get left in their drawer after a month or so. The trick is to hopefully make these things sticky, engaging, being connected with digital coaches that can learn you and kind of nudge you in the right direction. And can shift us again from waiting for disease to happen to using some of our digital exhaust and other pieces of information to really tune healthcare for the individual.
But you got things like I spoke about Huxley Brave New World. I mean, you got a smart path now that can essentially collect all the data they do in intensive care. You got ultrasound. You're just kind of plugging into a smartphone. I mean, you read about this stuff and you wonder maybe. Is there too much technology? If somebody said to me, boy, you know, kids have to learn Band-Aids and things like that, Mercurochrome and things like that.
It's a bit of a brave new world, and it's a bit of a generational shift in how we, you know, we practice sick care today. We spend most of our time and money on folks who already have disease, and we can really move to more proactive, continuous healthcare using some of these new tools. So there are little Band-Aid patches, some from a Bay Area company called Vital Connect, which can literally stream your full-on EKG, your temperature, your posture, your temperature. That's a lot of data. No clinician wants to be looking at that 24/7.
And again, you need the platforms too.
And the platforms are starting to come together. So with things like the big consumer companies, Apple, Samsung, Google, enabling data to flow through your wearables, your scale, your blood pressure cuff, your glucometer, through your smartphone, now in the last year, into your electronic medical record. So at Stanford now, with a single click on my phone now, my data flows to my primary care doctor. He can see that. Now, he doesn't want to log in and look to 2,000 patients' data. The future will be more of having individualized check engine lights where the information like your modern car is synthesized and shows you a little warning light and says, hey, Michael, time to come in for that checkup before you blow a gasket. And as we start to connect sort of our bodies like our cars are becoming connected, we can maybe even crowdsource some of this healthcare. We wouldn't imagine, you know, 10 years ago we didn't have smartphones. We can't imagine driving without Google Maps or Waze. There's an opportunity to connect some of those dots and be data donors and share that information as well.
Talking with Daniel Kraft, MD, Faculty Chair for Medicine and Neuroscience at Singularity University. He's also founder and chair of Exponential Medicine, which is a program exploring developing technologies and their potential in biomedicine and healthcare. And he'll be speaking at World's Fair Nano this Saturday at 4:30 p.m. at Pier 70 in San Francisco. And we'll get a beat on that later on in the program. I want to know about what's being called Uberization of healthcare. You could bring back house calls, in fact. New healthcare standard, possibly?
Well, everyone is familiar with Uber as a disruptive company, especially for the taxis and limos. And they're an example of an exponential company. They couldn't have existed 10-plus years ago without smartphones, online maps, GPS, online payments. They connected the dots. And we see in healthcare so many issues of friction, and it's expensive and hard to understand your bill and to access even a standard medical visit. So I think we all want that ease and transparency of use that we're becoming used to with Uber. And now we're seeing that kind of mindset come not just to millennials, but older folks who want access to their clinical data, to their clinician. And now there are several companies that literally launched apps where you press a button and a doctor will come to you within 3 hours. And my little joke is, you know, not sure what kind of doctor you're going to get, but they can rate you and you can rate them.
That's a joke.
All right. But the ability, even Uber themselves did a pilot where in New York where you'd slide it over to Uber Health and press a button and a nurse would come and give you a flu shot. They're even piloting and helping bring patients to clinical visits that have access issues. So broadly, this idea of Uberization is that we can have transparency, we can have more ease of access, and that mindset's coming across many pieces of healthcare, including delivering your drugs, maybe by it's an Uber or Lyft, or soon by drone.
You got not only doctors coming to your door now, you got nurses in some of these new apps, yeah.
Right. A local company called Honor is helping with elderly care and older and home care. Lots of ways we can now bring services, whether it's meals, drugs, medical care. And some of that, of course, is now happening telepresently. Part of the future of healthcare is this sort of digital checkup. You don't need to go into the clinical office every time, wait 66 minutes for that 12-minute visit. Some of that's going to be more and more augmented, sometimes through your phone, sometimes through things like Amazon Echo and our Google Homes, which will be our communication tools and can help us manage things like diabetes or just keep you on top of your exercise regimen.
This future of healthcare really gets into some fascinating areas, and there's an incredible range and array of changes going on. It's much more than most people can almost take in, and I'm just wondering, about the concern that many people have. First of all, I mean, think about Uber doctor coming and the time that is spent coming to your home as opposed to the time that might be spent in the office. And those are questions, I think, on people's minds. But the bigger question has to do with privacy.
Sure. I mean, part of that piece about the doctor traveling and coming to you is going to shift into where the incentives are. So we're moving from fee-for-service to more the buzzword is value-based care. We're going to start paying for results. And sometimes your insurance company or hospital system may pay for that Uber-type doctor. But privacy is a big concern now with our digital exhaust that can tell a lot about you, where you've been and what you're doing. Your genomics, which I could sequence from you today for less than $1,000, could give me a lot of insights into your future health prognoses. So we have to be careful about data privacy, but I don't think we want to sort of squelch innovation. There's HIPAA, we're all familiar with, filling that same out form. That often scares folks from smart innovations that can use data and share it. And now that we're not sure what's going to happen with Obamacare or Trumpcare or Putincare, we need to think about how we can sort of stimulate the sharing of data in smart, smart opt-in ways, even using technologies like blockchain to enable that, to help data flow and to kind of create that crowdsourced future of healthcare.
Well, we're not going to certainly control behavior with technology. I mean, I think you've addressed this in your TED Talk and everything, but there is even digital apps for, well, mental health care.
Sure. Well, behavior is the crux. You know, our genomics are important, our genes for our health, but much more impactful is our behaviors, particularly over the long term, how much we sleep, our alcohol intake, our stress level. And now with some of these wearables and other technologies, we can get a pulse on our behavior. Sort of right now, I'm wearing a couple of devices that track my sleep, even a ring that can do this, or I have a sensor in my mattress. Just getting insight into my sleep and my behaviors of when I go to bed, when I get up. It's hard because I have a young child at home that wakes up at 4 a.m. But that has huge impact on health and wellness over the long term.
Aren't there also things that can gauge depression and anxiety?
And same thing. There's your phone, for example, can tell how much you're obviously texting and moving. Your voice can be a biomarker for mental health. We're seeing companies locally like Ginger.io that are literally a platform to detect mental health progression. So, for example, a bipolar patient, if you're depressed and not moving much and not texting and staying in the house versus being manic, your phone can tell. And some of these new digital mental health platforms are enabling you to access your care team, your family, and to give you digital hugs when you might need one.
And Google Glass is not dead.
Well, Google Glass was kind of the first foray into sort of augmented or virtual reality coming to all of us. And while the initial version will soon look like an antique, augmented reality and virtual reality are an example of convergent technologies impacting healthcare. One of the best applications is using a Google Glass or similar product for a physician to see their patient, see data, and have someone else watching that visit and scribing. Because physicians today spend twice as much time typing in their medical record than actually space time with their patient. We need to help technology improve the patient-doctor relationship. So that's one example. Or we're seeing now versions of Oculus Rift or Microsoft HoloLens enable education for medical students to learn anatomy. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. And if you went back and used your early iPhone 1, it would feel antique. We're going to see these Google Glasses of a couple of years ago seem antique soon. And there's many new applications to bring those both for the patient, the nurse, the physician to augment our education and engagement with health information.
We're talking again with Daniel Kraft, who is faculty chair for medicine and neuroscience with Singularity University. And he'll be speaking at World's Fair Nano this Saturday, 4:30 p.m., Pier 70 in San Francisco. You're talking about genome sequencing and think about 23andMe and Veritas Genetics. There's lots of things that are going on, again, with respect to healthcare and being able to predict. And in fact, I believe we're at a point now, aren't we, where you can screen for Alzheimer's for about 10 years hence, which is pretty scary. I mean, many people say, I don't want to know. But at the same time, you make the argument that they can get on medications and sort of ameliorate.
Right, potentially. So, you know, I come from the oncology world. We're kind of unfortunately used to patients presenting with stage 3 and stage 4 disease. Alzheimer's, usually when we start trying to treat it, it's already quite advanced. So part of the future and cutting edge of today is to use some of these new screening tools. There's app-based eye tracking devices. There's blood-based diagnostics. There's brain scans that might pick up dementia 10 or 15 years early. And now drugs in development that might stop a reverse plaque might be taken when you're at stage 0 before you have symptoms to abrogate it ever occurring. So I think that's part of the health of medicine. Part of this future is to pick up disease early, individualize your screening. Even if with your 23andMe data, I could have some insights if I'm your primary care doctor as when to screen you, what drugs might be best for like a statin based on your pharmacogenomics. The challenge today is a lot of this information doesn't yet flow to your clinician. They're not incentivized to use it, in some cases disincentivized. And we need to help this come together to really catalyze better outcomes.
What about the calculus between money, revenue, if you will, funding basic health care, especially now with possibly likely the dismantling of the Affordable Care Act, as opposed to technology care? I mean, there's kind of a dichotomy there, isn't there? It's a binary almost.
I think it's a bit of more of a blend. I mean, so folks talk about, you know, robot physicians or the app taking over your medical care. I think in many cases it's more of a blend. So not just artificial intelligence, AI, but more IA, intelligence augmentation, which will help clinicians and patients across the spectrum. So one example might be fields like dermatology or radiology or pathology, where clinicians are used and trained to see patterns. Now machine learning can arguably do that faster and better. So that can augment a primary care doctor to help screen you for melanoma, for example. I think we have to blend them together. It's not going to always replace, but we're seeing the ability to do, let's say, triage with chatbots that you might access through your phone or from your home connected devices that can help you do the first steps. I've been involved with the XPRIZE in designing prizes to make medical tricorders inspired by Star Trek. So in your home, in your pocket, and I've got a few with me here, you can literally pull down advanced vital signs that syncs through your phone, can connect your clinician, and the AI sort of agents can help understand where you are on your baseline and when things are moving. So lots of potential there to combine technologies, not either or.
Well, you've done some specialty work in bone marrow transplants as an oncologist, and it's a good example. I mean, there's now faster ways to harvest bone marrow, and this is what we call regenerative medicine. And regenerative medicine fits into the whole picture here of the future and where medicine is going in big ways. Talk about what some of the major things are as you see it.
So, yeah, my clinical background has been in bone marrow transplantation, which is a form of stem cell therapy we've been doing for 40 or more years. Where that's starting to blend is combining with new technologies like gene therapy, CRISPR. For example, I think one of the most exciting applications is now to take a patient with like sickle cell disease or thalassemia, where they have a single base pair gene that makes their blood sickle. We can now take out some of their marrow, potentially replace that with gene therapy through CRISPR or other methods, and retransplant them and cure them from this often chronic disease. Maybe it even has opportunities for HIV to put in genes that make the new T cells that come out of your bone marrow resistant. So that's an exciting approach. The idea of regenerative medicine is particularly exciting because we want to be able to replace, regenerate, or repair damaged or aged organs. One example that's quite exciting is blending of 3D printing and stem cells. So we potentially could print a new kidney or organ or liver. That's still, I think, a little farther downstream. What's most exciting is, I think, applying some of these new gene approaches like CRISPR to modify pig organs inside pigs to make them more human. And we may be even doing transplants from pigs, kind of animal farmish, might not be kosher, but to acquire organs given our huge organ shortage. So lots happening in that space and a lot of hype and a lot of hope, including in digital health, about these technologies.
Yeah, in fact, you know, we've certainly focused on some of these and there is a lot of hope and a lot of hype, as you say. I think that's certainly stating it as it is. And there's also some concerned about this fraud going on. I know, for example, there are I don't mean to necessarily indict anyone without proper adjudication, but there are people who are using stem cells. I think about Singularity University and the concern about extending longevity, saying we're going to shoot you full of stem cells and we're going to extend your longevity. There's a lot of that out there.
Well, there's a lot of interest I'm more interested in
People are going to get the shots, though. I mean, they're paying good money for
There are clinics around the world claiming they're doing, quote-unquote, stem cell therapy when there's no real stem cells involved. It's not proven by any reason of a clinical trial. So there's a lot of hope, but also, again, hype. And we need to be careful about these things. There can be a downside. For example, folks taking testosterone injections has a higher risk of cardiovascular disease and stroke. At Singularity University, and our website is su.org, a lot of information around technologies and where they're heading. We don't really focus on super longevity, but how we might take new approaches to address it in a multifactorial way to improve, again, lifespan and health span. There's a lot of work bringing in, whether it's telomerase, stem cells, even drugs like metformin, which we use for diabetes, which might extend life, that many folks are studying. The trick is how to put that together. And
gee, I'm diabetic, but I haven't had to go on metformin because my hemoglobin is good enough. Maybe I can extend my life if I go on metformin.
It may. But the challenge here, again, is connecting those dots. I was at the White House for the Cancer Moonshot Summit led by Vice President Biden.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
And a lot of the hope for whether it's cancer or extending life is helping folks connect those data points. A lot of data is blocked between UCSF and Stanford. It's hard to help data flow, let alone different electronic medical records, which often silo information, let alone between pharma companies. Part of, I think, of accelerating the future of healthcare is getting folks to cross-pollinate their information, open it up between institutions and individuals, and get us to sort of faster cures as well as better, smarter prevention.
Okay, we're talking to Daniel Kraft, who is faculty chair for medicine and neuroscience at Singularity University. He's also founder and chair of Exponential Medicine, a program exploring developing technologies and their potential in biomedicine and healthcare. And he'll be speaking at World's Fair Nano this Saturday at 4:30 p.m. at Pier 70 in San Francisco. And you are invited to join us talking about the next stage of medical technology and talking about potential and pitfalls of digital medicine, part of Forum's first person series, which profiles Bay Area innovators and leaders who make our region unique. Thoughts, questions, comments from you, our listeners, are welcome. Let me give you the toll-free number and invite you to join us. The number to call is 866-733-6786. You can join us now by calling that number. Again, it's 866-733-6786. A number of other ways, of course, to join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we do indeed invite you to become part of the program with things that concern you or questions you have or excitement that's being generated in your own household or in your own mind and heart. I want to ask you a little bit more. You mentioned it before, Daniel, about Oculus Rift and other things along those lines. A lot of this is going into medical education. How do you see all this digital revolution tied to medical education now?
Well, you know, how do we train a physician or a nurse today for this, you know, fast-moved, exponential future? Part of that may be using these now tools, which have started with video games, to educate a medical student, to learn anatomy, to fly through the heart, to do that collaboratively with classmates and teachers, to change the physiology and see that, to be able to fly through the brain and understand anatomy. So those already exist. We're seeing ways to even use virtual reality, which you can do on your smartphone and a Google Cardboard, to treat patients. For example, burn patients who are getting painful debridement surgeries are now been putting into a cold environment. They get to throw snowballs, and it lowers their pain threshold and their need for opiate drugs. Those are just a few examples. Or for kids with autism, they can put on things like Google Glass and learn to recognize facial emotions for angry or sad. And so what's most interesting in the example here through augmented and virtual reality is it's bringing folks with beginner's mind from other technologies together. What we do at my Exponential Medicine Conference is kind of unsilo technologies, patients, physicians, investors, technologists to think differently. But what we can do by sometimes converging or super converging technology, and I think AR and VR is an example. And one small one based on behavior change, which we talked about, which is hard, is what if when you looked in the mirror in the morning, you saw future you? Not just you of you today. That might help you quit smoking or change your diet or start an exercise regimen. When we can see the downstream implications of our behaviors, which can now be tracked, that could be quite helpful.
Coming up on a break, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about sensors. That's also the way of the future, more use of sensors in the home and just in our general life in general.
Well, we're not going to be just wearing these little wrist-based devices. They're disappearing into our cars, into our clothes. Wi-Fi, in fact, can now pick up the vital signs of up to 10 people in the same room. So for better or for worse, we're going to enter this age of digital exhaust 24/7. The trick is how do we use it, how do we maintain privacy, and how do we leverage that to more continuous, proactive, and participatory healthcare.
Also, questions about regulations, which perhaps we can get into in the course of this hour. But in the meantime, we're going to hear from you, our listeners, when we return. We're also going to talk with Michael Weiss, who is co-founder and CEO of World's Fair USA, and hear what that's all about. So stay tuned. We're talking to Dr. Daniel Kraft, faculty chair of medicine and neuroscience at Singularity University and founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. And when we return, you'll have your chance. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Daniel Kraft about the potential and pitfalls of digital medicine as part of our first-person series, which profiles Bay Area innovators and leaders who make our region unique. And Daniel Kraft, again, will be speaking at World's Fair Nano this Saturday at 4:30 p.m. at Pier 70 in San Francisco. We thought we'd find out a little bit more about World's Fair Nano. Michael Weiss is joining us. He's co-founder and CEO of World's Fair USA, and welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Michael, and hello, Daniel.
Glad to have you, and Daniel's nodding his head and smiling. Tell us what you have planned for this Saturday.
Yeah, so World's Fair Nano, it's all about letting people try the future. You know, our work, our goal is to basically make the future like coffee. If you want to get a coffee, you go to Starbucks. If you want information, you go to Google. If you want toothpaste, you go to Amazon and you order it. And they're all very easy. The barrier to entry to experience and have these things is very low. But today, you know, to experience the future, it's tough. And with World for Nano, we make that easy.
Well, you make it easy in the sense that you're bringing a lot of experts in to talk about a lot of different subjects. Daniel talking, obviously, about the future of medicine. What other experts have you managed to corral for this?
Yeah, there's the future of medicine. There's the future of cities, the future of art, the future of cannabis, the future of feminism. And we have people from, you know, the chief scientist of Salesforce talking about the future of artificial intelligence. Chip Conley from Airbnb talking about the future of hospitality. Tiffany Schlein, the founder of the Webby Awards, is talking about the future of feminism. It should be an awesome series for the speaking.
You got the World's Fair name on it. How does that work exactly? These are usually international events. We're focused here on Nano, aren't we? And local Bay Area.
Yeah, so our company's ultimate goal is to bring the World's Fair back to the U.S. World's Fair meaning a 6-month, tens of millions of people, international showcase of the future, a la 1915 San Francisco Palace of Fine Arts or 1939 San Francisco when they built Treasure Island as a landfill project for that World's Fair.
So how do people go about getting tickets? Where do they go online or how can they acquire them?
Yeah, the website, just worldsfairnano.com.
All right. Michael Weiss, I thank you for being with us.
Cool. Thanks, Michael. See you, Daniel.
See ya. Michael Weiss, again, is co-founder and CEO of World's Fair USA, and Daniel Kraft will be speaking there this Saturday, 4:30 p.m. at Pier 70 in San Francisco. A lot of comments about cost of what we're talking about here, Daniel Kraft. Ernst says, all this sounds like it's only for the wealthy. How will it help normal people, people who don't have access to smartphones or the Internet? Ben says, what's your organization doing to bring down the cost of healthcare? These product ideas are great if you have the money, but what about the average people who won't be able to afford these new whiz-bang products?
I would argue a lot of these products are already here. The things we'll see at this Nano World's Fair, I think, fit the theme of, you know, the future's already here, just not evenly distributed. We've seen the cost of everything from smartphones to drones come down exponentially. And I think even the poorest on the planet have SMS phones. Soon they're going to all have smartphones and be connected to the web through things like Google Loon and Facebook satellites. So I think we actually have the opportunity to dramatically lower costs because almost everyone has a digital device. That can become a portal to understanding your behaviors, tracking information, giving you a healthcare avatar to both guide you or connect you to your clinician. So I'd argue, especially by being more proactive and sort of managing our small behaviors over time, we can bring down healthcare costs rather than wait for the whiz bang, 3D printed organ or the head transplant.
What do you mean by exponential medicine?
So the conference I chair, Exponential Medicine, which we founded out of Singularity University 6 years ago, is really focused on what are the fast-moving technologies, ranging from information technology to AI and big data to 3D printing to even things like drones and robotics that are moving very quickly and can come together in new ways to address ways of doing prevention and health, diagnostics, and therapy. So every fall at the Hotel Del Coronado, we run a 700-person conference. You can see many of our past faculty and talks at exponentialmedicine.com, ranging from folks you know like Vinod Khosla, who's investing in the space, to Craig Venter, who sequenced the first genomes, all the way to George Church from Harvard Genomics. So it brings folks together from different worlds, and we ask, how do we understand technology, where it's coming together, and leverage that to impact medicine? And that's part of, again, our mission at Singularity University as well.
All right, lots of calls, and I want to get to them. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. But quick question from Noel, and it's an important one. What prevents hackers from getting in? What about privacy? And how can you prevent insurance companies from getting the information and discriminating against you?
Great questions. Sometimes many of these technologies, whether it's gene therapy or wearable digital devices, move faster than regulations and ethics and policy. I think we still use credit cards, even though those get hacked. We need to figure out smart ways to opt in. Again, maybe even using technologies like blockchain to share information in safe ways and be mindful of it, but not block progress. I think the best element, again, is for folks to decide to become a data donor, just like we use with Google Maps, and use that as a way to instigate the benefit for all of us.
Let's go to your calls, and let's begin with a caller from San Diego. John, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for having us. I'm a person living with HIV/AIDS for going on 35, maybe 36 years now. And I was just wondering, I always try to be proactive. What can I take from this conversation when I go to my doctor on my next visit that would introduce something to him? Because I'm also 63, so I'm aging, and I'm living with this disease. So what can I? How can I be proactive? And does Mr. Kraft have something to tell me that I can ask my doctor or bring to the table on my next visit?
Perfect question. I think part of us, part of this future, all of us, the new drug is often called the engaged, empowered patient, like you, who is on top of their medications per se. Maybe you want to start doing some simple tracking so that when your physician asks you, how were you 2 weeks ago? Or, how have you been? It might be hard for to remember, but now using simple wearables and an app, you can have some of that data, including about your sleep and how maybe the side effects of certain of your drug cocktails may be affecting you, and hopefully catalyze your clinician and others like him to start using that kind of real-time data to help you tune both your therapy and your long-term aging issues. Because again, a lot of this data is siloed. We're still faxing things around or sending PDFs. The more we can engage our clinicians and healthcare systems to use that data, I think, is part of it. So all of us can be catalyzing this future by engaging our clinicians using some of these new tools.
And let me thank the caller, but actually go to an important question here. I mean, there's been all this accelerated, incredible growth that we've been talking about, mobile health apps and so forth, but there's also been a concomitant concern about replacing regular doctor visits and regular medical care.
Well, absolutely. I think, Morgan, it's a bit of a convergence. We don't need to always replace them, but maybe every visit doesn't need to require you to take off half a day of work and sit and wait in the waiting room and fill out the same forms with a number two pencil. It might be a follow-up using your smartphone to look at your wound after a surgery or to check on a suspicious skin lesion. I think as the cost pressures go, we'll be seeing more and more payment for some of these telehealth platforms or maybe even AI chatbots that do that early triage piece so that physicians, pharmacists, and others are acting at the top of their license, not sort of seeing the low-end stuff that sometimes machine learning and simple algorithms can help manage.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about chatbots, and let's go to more of our callers. Matt, let's get you aboard here. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Kraft. My name is Matt. I live in San Francisco. I'm 25, so the potential for all this medical equipment is really interesting to me. I was just wondering, in terms of the data, who would actually own the data? Would it be private companies? And then could these private companies then in turn sell the data to, say, insurance companies so they can keep an eye on you and raise rates based on your daily activities? Or
right. Important question. No perfect answer, but I would advocate that you should own your own data and be able to share it as you wish, whether it's from your wearables or your pacemaker, if you happen to have one. There's a lot of issues about patients included or e-patient Dave, give me my damn data so we can own it. It's still very hard to access your own medical information, whether it's from your clinic, your hospital, or your insurance company. So I would argue that we all need to sort of instigate for owning our data, being able to share it when we want to. And some of the laws and regulations need to help keep discrimination in check.
Matt, I thank you for the call. And here's Chelsea. Chelsea, you're on with us.
Hi, good morning. I have type 1 diabetes, and I wear a continuous glucose monitor as well as a pump. My CGM actually goes straight to my phone, and it really has changed living with diabetes for me. But the cost, like we talked about before, is super prohibitive. So how can we work with the government and the FDA to actually lower these costs and improve these kinds of diagnostic tools? Because these are also part of preventative care and can really improve our healthcare long term.
Yeah, diabetes is a great example that's being shifted with technology. In your case, you have a sensor that measures your blood sugar, can talk to your phone, but then usually that does not connect directly back to your pump. The FDA has been challenged with how to make these sort of artificial pancreases, in a sense, be approved. And the FDA needs our help to speed up. They're very much a linear organization rather than an exponential one. I would argue using maybe a bit more of an expensive pump than using a syringe, you're going to have better blood sugars, better long-term outcomes, which will overall lower costs. So I think we need to be smart about catalyzing the combination of data, letting you see that information, tying that to the cloud, crowdsourcing that, optimizing your diet and activity, and that should be paid for in this new era of value-based care.
We're with Daniel Kraft, MD, faculty chair for medicine and neuroscience with Singularity University, and he's also founder and chair of Exponential Medicine, which is a program that explores developing technologies and their potential in both biomedicine and healthcare. More security and privacy concerns. Let me give you a couple of examples of that coming into us. Suzanne writes, the technological innovations Dr. Kraft is speaking of are exciting. However, there are lots of articles out about the lack of security in many Internet of Things devices. What is the most impressive work being done that he knows of to make the Internet of Things more secure? And what specifically is being done at medical facilities?
Well, the medical facilities are being very challenged. There's several examples of them being sort of hijacked by hackers, which have locked down their medical records and asked for ransoms, which some hospital systems have paid. We have seen examples where folks might be afraid that their genome might get hacked. If they're running for president, that might be an issue. Just go watch the movie Gattaca from 20 years ago to see some of the issues around genetics and gene privacy. So I think a lot of folks are starting to think about this issue. Part of it is, again, thinking about how we layer, whether it's blockchain or other layers of encryption on this information, where does it live? As more of our digital health information flows through our connected consumer devices, whether that's your watch or your Facebook feed, there's a lot of challenges there. So I think we need to think smartly about it, not be overly
scared.
It's
a big issue.
It's a big issue. Really, I don't have the full issue. Answer. I think we need to get great minds around it and not let it sort of impede progress.
I've been looking for those great minds. I hope they will come forward. Here's some pushback from Masha, who says, many of us can imagine driving without GPS because we do. We do so because we value our bodies, minds, brains, and imaginations. I prefer to map in my mind rather than be directed by a non-human. If the corporate model prevails, data will be used against us, not for us, regardless of the Hippocratic Oath and the best intentions of good doctors and nurses.
Mm. That's a wonderful point. I don't have the perfect response, just to say that this GPS example, we're still often driving relatively blind, whether we know where the traffic is or not. I think part of this potential, this new connected digital and omics age, is to make sense of the map. So even work at UCSF with the tool Butte and others are starting to map medical records to show you where your path might be or how to optimize your path to wellness or to managing a disease. So I think the good outweighs the bad, but we do need to be mindful about who owns that data, who controls it, and how it can be used for or against us.
More of your calls. Yinan joins us. Yinan, welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Fascinating program. My question is, first of all, I agree with Mr. Kraft here that modernizing or uberizing the healthcare is something that both consumers and doctors, patients, and the industry wants. However, there would be some challenges when it comes to applying those Uberized services over an outdated infrastructure, IT healthcare infrastructure, which is not accommodated to accept this type of new services. There is a big challenge there. How do you think it will be resolved?
Well, there are many misaligned incentives in our healthcare systems. And again, in the U.S. alone, there are many healthcare systems. The VA, Geisinger, Kaiser all work differently than a Stanford or UCSF. So some of these services may work in certain localities and systems and states other than in others. You know, Texas outlawed telemedicine, essentially. So part of it, I think, is aligning the incentives to reward a telepsychology follow-up, for example, to reward your healthcare system to enable the data to flow from your smartphone into your medical record, to make those medical records more functional, not just as records and billing machines, which they really are today, but to give your clinician the ability to have a dashboard to help guide your prevention, diagnostics, and therapy. And we need to modernize. We can't be stuck on the same old roads that we have in some states.
This can be, at least potentially, a great enhancement for preventive medicine.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is essentially the goal, to be much more proactive, personalized, and preventative. So if, Michael, I'm your primary care doctor and I happen to know your genome, your microbiome, your digital health exhaust, and I can put that together and see that in smart ways, enhanced with AI, machine learning, I can be much more smart about when to screen you, how to guide you to longevity, how to manage a disease if you have one, and to hopefully use that from across different healthcare systems. So we're learning from around the globe, just like Tesla cars today. They're essentially self-driving. They update themselves. They educate themselves in this hive mind to create smarter driving maps. And I think some of that can come to health and medicine.
We'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Dan in Los Altos. You're on.
Hello, WikiLeaks. I think we all have that to some degree in our mind. I'm very excited by all of the promises that having this great technology furthering our scientific knowledge and medical knowledge. But then once it's out there, and I think all of us have deep misgivings about how secure that is. One of the things I just want to throw in there is, of course, the legal community would have to come in. Right now, we have a lot of servers up in Canada because it's colder up there. And if it goes across an international border, if my health care information is going to Canada, that means the United States government can peer into it without really much of any sort of warrant. So there are a lot of implications here. I'd like to hear your guess. Response to that.
All right, we'll go to Dr. Kraft.
Well, with the caveat that I'm not a health or data security expert, I think, you know, we need to be aware of those sorts of issues. We hopefully need to stimulate whether it's Congress or the FDA or the FCC to think about how to maintain that information in smart ways, to encrypt it, to provide easier ways so that it's not, again, if I need to get a medical record from another hospital today, I'm also often filling out and faxing a form over there to let the data flow to help a patient when they're an acute issue in the ER or to manage their health. So as a lot of exponential technology speed up, whether it's AI or low-cost genomics, we need to help the regulatory and other bodies be smart about it without, I think, stifling innovation. Just like here in the Bay Area in the early 70s with molecular biology and the ability to splice genes, many folks thought we'd be playing God and shouldn't do that. But folks like Paul Berg and others at Asilomar came together and helped create some guidelines as how to smartly leverage molecular biology. We need to have some of that same mindset around digital health data and this new brave world of many technologies impacting healthcare.
And we go to more of your calls. Let's go to Ahmed next. Ahmed, you're on.
Hi, thanks for the call. Dr. Kraft, really, really interesting discussion. My name is Ahmed. I'm a pediatric hospitalist at Lukeville Packard Children's Stanford in the Bay Area and do some work with technology at the bedside. But I was more interested to hear what's going on kind of in the world of pediatrics and technology. You know, our patient population is unique. A lot of the times they can't tell us what's wrong. They don't really know how to track their own kind of health information. We're relying on surrogates. So I'm curious about what all do you know about technology that's going on to further the care of pediatrics.
Well, sure. I trained in internal medicine and pediatrics and did my fellowship at Packard Children's.
Oh, nice.
And I was just, for example, at the Consumer Electronics Show. There's a lot of new technologies coming for pregnant women and for young children to help track their activity and hopefully be proactive. Some things as simple as a connected otoscope can enable you to track kids with ear infections when they go home instead of dragging them back, kicking and screaming. We're seeing now sensored cribs or little anklet braces, kind of like a Fitbit for babies that can help reassure worried parents or enable a pediatrician like yourself to send a child home earlier so you can monitor them in smart ways, whether they have risk of SIDS or have asthma. So I think we're starting to see this advent of connecting those dots. Again, how does that information flow to you? How do you access it? How do you not get overwhelmed by it? How are you incentivized to use it are still part of the challenge.
And we thank you for the call, Ahmed. In fact, here's a tweet that kind of dovetails. Only 10% share your tweets of healthcare is provided by clinicians. What innovations are happening in the patient family space?
Well, healthcare is at home. Healthcare is social. We spend 99.9% of our time, hopefully, outside of the clinic or the ER. So I think we need to, whether it's healthy meals or the ability to connect folks socially to support them when they have a medical issue or to encourage them to run or get better sleep are all super important. I think in terms of alternative medicines, essentially lessons from the West, mindfulness, meditation, yoga, those are essentially great proactive healthcare regimens. We're seeing technology blend. There's apps to help you meditate. There's brain-computer interfaces you can buy online that help you optimize your mindfulness state. So I think there's a whole convergence. It's not just the old-fashioned take a pill or here's a drug or a prescribed app.
What do you say to Heidi Jane, a listener who writes, I think this sounds insane. There is so much scientific evidence out there proving how much stress apps put on our lives. Has this been factored into the health equation too?
Well, there are thousands of apps. Most of them haven't been very well rated or validated. The FDA is struggling with how to regulate certain apps. I think we'll see the convergence maybe into your single sort of health chatbot, your Dr. Siri or some similar element. It's going to know you. Your behavioral type will tune to your sort of needs. So we're not logging into apps. We don't want to be overwhelmed with data. We want the actionable, useful information when we need it, when it's useful.
Here's Joan. Joan, you're on.
Thank you. How about external sensors in your house and in your yard to detect the air and the water so the people in Flint, Michigan would know there was individual consumers would know that their water was going to poison their children when the government didn't want to tell them and before their children came down with a terrible disease. Things to test environmental toxins for farm workers, for example, when they're working in a field, there's too much of who knows what toxin in this field, and we shouldn't be in this field.
Well, now that you're a population expert, public health can be dramatically accelerated through low-cost sensors. They can live in everyone's home, on your bodies, in your cars, and share that information to be identifying whether it's a pandemic like avian flu or something like Ebola or worse, or to pick up signs in the environment that are changing. And public health, the environment, whether you're getting a ping to say the pollution that day means you should take extra asthma medications, all those are really valuable and can save many lives.
And a reminder that, excuse me, you're listening to Forum, and Dr. Daniel Kraft is with us, faculty chair for medicine and neuroscience at Singularity University. He's also founder and chair of Exponential Medicine, a program that explores developing technologies and their potential in biomedicine and in healthcare. And he'll be speaking at World's Fair Nano this Saturday, 4:30 at Pier 70 in San Francisco. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. We urge you to participate in fundraising and support this radio station and all that it does for you and for the public. And for more information about how to support it, go to KQED, kqed.org. And I want to remind you that I'm your host, and my name is Michael Krasny. Let's go to a quick break, and then we'll be right back. Let me actually go to more of your phone calls. Let me go to Alameda and welcome Sam. Sam, you're on.
Hi, how are you? Good morning. Thank you. This is a very interesting conversation. I've been in health tech for quite a long time. I have a question and a comment. My question is, what are the ethical or legal limitations for me to produce my own stem cells for doing my own self-testing, like, for example, injecting my own stem cells into my own body. And I was going to make a comment on another caller's comment, but I forgot what it was. So,
well, let's go to your question first, then we can come back to you. Go ahead, Daniel.
So you're all familiar, I think, with a lot of the debate around embryonic stem cells and the ethical and religious implications. But I think what's most exciting is now this caller, all of us, can take a skin cell or a cell from our blood and essentially reprogram that to be your own pluripotent stem cell line. These are called induced pluripotent stem cells. The Nobel Prize in Medicine awarded for this a couple years ago. So yes, you could today even send to some companies a little bit of your skin. They'll make your own stem cell lines. They can make different tissues. Now, it's a long step from being able to make your own cardiomyocytes or liver cells or others and injecting them into your body and having that actually treat a condition. And a lot of safety and other issues are involved in that.
Let me thank the caller, but you had a comment too, Sam. Go ahead.
I did. My apologies. It was a long wait. I forgot. But are there no legal preclusions from me producing my own stem cells and doing whatever I want with them?
Well, today in my world of bone marrow transplant, we're often taking out cells from the bone marrow, putting them back in to treat cancer, but in some cases to treat heart disease or critical limb ischemia and maybe other disorders. There's still challenges as to whether that always works. If it's your own cells going back to your own body, that can often be done. If you're taking them out and manipulating them, putting in genes, the FDA gets more and more involved, and we still want to show that these things are safe and effective.
And let me thank you for the call. As long as we're talking about stem cells, and as you said, there was certainly a lot of hope and still is and hype attached to stem cells. Stanley Prusner, who's local and won the Nobel Prize, did research on prions and felt that there was maybe more for us in the way of future healthcare in prions than there are in stem cells.
I don't know a lot about prions, to be honest, but I think, again, we need to unsilo thinking about things, whether it's stem cells or digital health or prions, and look at where these things can come together. I think there's a lot of potential in this era of systems medicine, systems biology, to combine different data points and technologies.
You're a big advocate of convergences.
Yeah, I mean, because really it's no one size fits all solution, whether it's the pill or the app or the behavioral change modification. All this is like politics, local. It needs to adapt to you, to your history, your genomics. And that's part of the challenge and opportunity to bring this all together.
Let's go back to some of the devices that are already out there and some of the things that can help. I mean, smartwatches, heart rate, they can let you know essentially about your glucose. And Also, now blood pressure monitoring is being talked about, yeah?
Sure. I've got a couple devices in my pocket that can sort of calculate your blood pressure just by holding the device. They're not perfect yet. There's now a watch that was recently in trials that will actually squeeze your wrist and do real-time blood pressure monitoring in a watch. Blood pressure is a great example of a pretty common condition. 1 in 3 Americans has hypertension. Less than half have it well controlled. What if I'm your clinician? I can send you home with a connected blood pressure cuff and an app that adapts to your blood pressure, helps you adjust your medications. That data flows back to me. That's a great example of a pretty simple measure that can be hugely impactful across healthcare. And again, our wristwatch, the companies like Apple and Samsung are building more and more sensors into those and will learn what to do with that. Google Health, or Verily now, is doing a baseline project. We haven't had millions or thousands of people out there with this sort of data. We don't know what to do with it. We've just had heart rate, weight, blood pressure. Now we have potentially thousands or more data points to make sense of to tune prevention, diagnostics, and therapy.
Can also, I mean, as I said, a lot of different ways that prevention can fit in here. But there are ways if you're driving along and you want to find out if you've had too much to drink, you can simply do an alcohol analysis or at least get a breathalyzer type of device right in your smartphone.
The breathalyzers aren't in your phone yet. Some of them, if your alcohol level is too high, will lock you out of your car and call you an Uber.
Right.
But breath is something we can start to quantify to pick up things like lung cancer, circulating molecules that are excreted in your breath.
You just get right into your lungs. You know?
Well, the molecules you breathe out are indicative of your physiology or the quality of your breath or hydration if you're going on a date. We're going to see, hopefully, and I've just been involved in a couple X Prizes. A new one we're initiating is for low-cost cancer diagnostics. How can we take something as simple as a urine dipstick test for pregnancy and take that model for picking up cancer early rather than what we have is late? So I think we can start to quantify everything from our wrist-raced EKGs to our breath to our urine to our environment.
Seconds left, but Mark, let's get you on here from Palo Alto. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. My question is, what are the implications for medical education?
Let's go to that right away, if we could, Daniel Craig.
Medical education isn't just for the clinician, but for the individual to understand their own risks, their disease, their prevention. We can use a whole set of new tools from apps to chatbots to virtual reality to really catalyze that. So encourage you to try these things today. A lot of them exist today. They're not perfect, but are part of this future of health and medicine.
Well, again, it's a brave new world. I thank you for outlining it and helping us spotlight and understand it. Daniel Craft, again, with us this hour as part of our First Person series. Inform is produced by Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. And our engineer is Danny Bringer, engagement producer Amanda Stupai. Our executive producer, our senior editor Dan Zoll, and our executive producer Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.